So, if I asked you to name the most dangerous thing in the ocean, I mean, you would probably picture a dorsal fin breaking the surface.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And you instantly hear that certain two-note movie soundtrack playing in your head. We are practically wired to feel this absolute terror at the mere thought of a shark.
Yeah, that classic dun 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 dun. It is completely burned into our brains.
It really is. But, like, what if the real threat isn't the shadow in the water? What if the actual threat is the absolute catastrophic ecosystem collapse that happens if that shadow disappears?
Right, which is a terrifying thought on its own.
Exactly. So today on the Deep Dive, we are tearing down millions of dollars of bad PR. We're looking at this fascinating resource. It's an independent field atlas called Red Sea Creatures.
Such a great resource, by the way.
It really is. And we are exploring the very surprising reality behind Shark Awareness Day, which, just as a reminder, falls on July 14th, 2026. The whole mission today is to investigate why these ancient animals desperately need a massive rebranding campaign.
Right, and how we can shift our collective mindset, from fear to awe.
Yes, because they need it.
It is a vital mission. And the objective with this analysis isn't just to hand out like a list of aquatic trivia for your next pub night.
Yeah, no, this is way bigger than that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are looking at the fundamental mechanics of the ocean. We really have to understand how absolutely crucial these apex predators are to the very survival of marine ecosystems.
Right.
Because without them, the entire architecture of the ocean changes, and the cascading effects are just severe.
Okay, let's unpack this. If you are listening to this right now, I want you to mentally erase every blockbuster movie you've ever seen about a shark.
Just throw them out.
Literally throw out the sensationalized news alerts. To really grasp why a global event like Shark Awareness Day even exists, we have to look at the immense gap between what the media constantly feeds us and what the ocean actually requires to function.
That's a huge disconnect.
It is. The text points out that sharks suffer heavily from, quote, sensational media portrayals. And, reading through the field atlas, I couldn't help but think of an analogy.
Oh, I love a good analogy. Lay it on me.
Well, it's like we've cast them as the mindless slasher movie villain of the ocean, right?
Yeah.
Just swimming around looking for victims, when in reality, they are the building's structural
That's
engineers.
a really good way to put it.
Right. They are the ones inspecting the foundation, fixing the cracks, and keeping the whole ecosystem from just completely collapsing in on itself. But I need to understand the physical mechanics of that.
Sure.
Like, how does a predator actually keep a building from falling down?
Well, what's fascinating here is the complete inversion of the popular narrative. When you look at the data coming out of the field atlas, the irony becomes almost painful.
How so?
Because these animals aren't interested in us. We aren't on their menu. Most shark species are entirely harmless to humans.
Which is wild to think about, given how terrified we are of them.
Exactly. But to address your structural engineering analogy, we really have to look at a concept called top-down control.
Okay, top-down control.
Yeah. As apex predators, they sit at the very top of the food web. Their daily routine involves hunting, obviously, but they don't just swim around eating the healthiest prime fish at random.
Wait, they don't?
No, they generally target the weak, the sick, and the slow among their prey.
Oh, wow. So it's like a brutal sort of ecosystem triage.
That is exactly what it is.
I mean, they probably don't do it out of altruism, right? They do it because sick fish are slower and just require fewer calories to catch.
Yeah, they're being efficient.
But the byproduct of that laziness is a healthier fish population overall.
That is the perfect way to look at it. By removing the sick individuals, they literally prevent diseases from spreading through massive populations of schooling fish.
Oh, that makes total sense.
Right. They act as the immune system of the ocean. But the structural engineering goes even deeper than disease control. It's about population management through something called a trophic cascade.
A trophic cascade. Okay, break that chain reaction down for me.
Sure. So by keeping the populations of mid-level predators, think of like large groupers or snappers in check, sharks ensure that those mid-level fish don't overpopulate the reef.
Wait, so just by eating fish, the shark is actually keeping the reef functioning.
Exactly.
If a predator, like a tiger shark, just disappears tomorrow, what happens to the rest of the reef?
Well, if the tiger shark disappears, those mid-level predators suddenly have no natural enemies.
Right.
So their populations explode. And because there are now so many of them, they need to eat a massive amount of food.
Which means they eat all the smaller fish.
Precisely. They completely decimate the populations of herbivores. These are the smaller fish, like parrotfish, whose entire job is to swim around eating algae off the coral reefs and seagrass beds.
And without those herbivores, I'm guessing the algae just grows unchecked.
It completely takes over. The coral reefs literally suffocate under this thick blanket of algae. The corals die, the physical structure crumbles, and the entire habitat is wiped out.
All that just from losing one predator.
Yes. The seagrass beds wither away too, which destroys the nursery grounds for juvenile fish. The whole ecosystem collapses from the bottom up, all because that top-down control was removed.
Wow.
That trophic cascade is the structural engineering you were talking about.
That is unbelievable. The profound reality here is that these creatures we view as the ultimate threat, they are actually the ecological baseline keeping the lights on in the ocean.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
It's a total inversion of how we treat them in pop culture. We treat them as liabilities, but they are the foundation.
Exactly.
And once you understand that they aren't just mindless killers, you start to look at their history. And this is where the sheer scale of the information just gets wild to me.
Oh, the timeline is incredible.
It really is. To appreciate what is at stake if we lose them, we have to look at that timeline. I was reading the fun facts section of this atlas, and it drops this staggering detail.
Let me guess. Their age.
Yes. Sharks have been around for over 420 million years. That completely breaks my mental timeline of Earth.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
I always pictured sharks evolving alongside, like, the T-Rex. But the text explicitly says they are older than dinosaurs and older than trees. Wait, older than trees?
Older than trees.
If they predate terrestrial forests, that means they survived the asteroid, volcanic winters, literally everything.
Everything the planet threw at them.
Their biology must be incredibly resistant to rapid environmental shifts. How did they actually manage to survive multiple global mass extinctions before the first leaf ever even existed on land?
It is an almost incomprehensible span of time. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, we are talking about the ultimate evolutionary survivors.
Yeah, 420 million years is just, it's wild.
It means sharks have swum through different iterations of planet Earth. I mean, they survived the Permian-Triassic extinction event.
Which was huge, right?
Oh, massive. Hmm. It wiped out roughly 96% of all marine species.
Wait, how do you even survive something that kills 96% of the ocean? Did they just, like, hide out in the deep water?
Well, deep water refuges played a huge part, yes. The deep ocean is somewhat insulated from a lot of the rapid atmospheric changes that happen on the surface.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it's also about their incredible biological adaptability.
Oh.
Over millions of years, they developed incredibly varied diets.
Right, because there are so many different types of sharks.
Exactly. Some became apex predators, others became bottom feeders, some even evolved to filter feed on plankton. They weren't hyper-specialized to just one fragile food source or one specific temperature zone.
So they didn't put all their eggs in one basket.
Right. They spread out across the globe, adapting to everything from freezing Arctic waters to warm, shallow, tropical reefs. Their biology is a masterpiece of evolutionary resilience.
It sounds perfectly tuned to the natural rhythms of the planet.
It really is. It's tuned to those slow geological changes.
But that brings up the million-dollar question, doesn't it? If their biology is a masterpiece of survival, why is the current climate and human impact suddenly their kryptonite?
That is the tragic part.
Like, why are they losing the battle for survival right now?
It really comes down to the speed of the threat. Their 420 million year resilience is unmatched in the natural world, but it is entirely unequipped for modern industrial human threats.
Because we move too fast.
Exactly. Evolution works on a scale of millennia. It allows a species to adapt to gradually warming seas or shifting continents over tens of thousands of generations.
Right. Slow changes.
But evolution cannot design a biological defense mechanism against a floating plastic bag.
Yeah.
It cannot build an immunity to industrial longline fishing.
Because longline fishing operates at a mechanical scale, not an ecological one.
Exactly.
I mean, we were talking about miles of fishing lines, right? With thousands of baited hooks dragging behind just a single commercial vessel.
Yes. And those vessels pull millions of sharks from the water in a single year. Sometimes intentionally for their fins, but often just accidentally as bycatch.
That is devastating.
It really is. And the problem is, a shark's natural reproduction rate is incredibly slow.
How slow are we talking?
Well, many species take years, sometimes decades, to reach sexual maturity. And then they only produce a handful of pups.
Wow, so they can't just bounce back like other fish.
Exactly. When you combine that extremely slow reproduction with the hyper-efficient mechanized slaughter of industrial fishing, the population math simply breaks.
It just doesn't work.
We are watching an ancient lineage, one perfectly designed to outlast asteroids, being decimated by unsustainable fishing and habitat loss. And it's happening at a speed that makes evolutionary adaptation utterly impossible.
That puts such a heavy historical weight on this whole discussion. We aren't just losing a fish, you know. We are severing a 420 million year unbroken chain of life.
This is a sobering reality.
Which makes the fight to save them feel incredibly daunting. You look at these massive global prehistoric scales, hundreds of millions of years, global commercial fishing fleets, the entire ocean's ecosystem. It all just feels way too big to tackle.
It's easy to feel paralyzed by the scale of it.
Right. But here's where it gets really interesting to me. The material we are looking at brings all of this down to a hyper-local, deeply personal level.
It really does.
All of this vital information, this entire species catalog we've been talking about, comes from that project called Red Sea Creatures. And it's an independent AdLite Field Atlas built by a single person.
Yeah, one individual.
One Paddy dive master based out of Elguna, Egypt.
It is a striking contrast, isn't it? You have the sheer incomprehensible scale of the species history on one side, and then the highly focused grassroots nature of the advocacy on the other.
Yeah, it's not some massive, well-funded corporate NGO. It's one person clearly passionate about the ocean, literally cataloging the marine life of the Red Sea, creature by creature.
It's incredible dedication.
But what does building a field atlas actually look like in practice? Because I'm picturing someone just taking an underwater camera and snapping a few fun photos on the weekend. But an atlas implies a serious level of data collection.
Oh, building a comprehensive field atlas is painstaking work. It requires thousands of hours underwater.
Thousands of hours. Wow.
Yes. A dive master doing this kind of cataloging is noting depths, tracking seasonal water temperatures, observing specific behavioral patterns.
So they're really acting as a marine biologist in the field.
Exactly. They are documenting where certain species congregate to breed or feed. They're building a baseline of ecological data. And that grassroots dedication is vital for conservation.
Because it provides the real numbers.
Right. The materials note that Shark Awareness Day has grown internationally, often running alongside huge commercial broadcasting events. Like Shark Week.
Right, everyone knows Shark Week.
And those big television events are great for broad visibility. But grassroots efforts, like this independent atlas, are where the tangible educational work really happens.
It connects the dots.
Yes, this atlas bridges the gap between an abstract global holiday and the physical reality of the ocean.
It gives the holiday actual stakes. When you look at the specific species cataloged in the material, you see the scalloped hammerhead, the tiger shark, the oceanic white tip, the black-tip reef shark.
All fascinating creatures.
Just hearing the specific names makes it feel a lot more real. It's not just a generic Save the Sharks bumper sticker, you know. It's a mission to save the oceanic white tip, a creature with distinct behaviors and a very specific role in its local ecosystem.
Naming them and understanding their specific conservation status transforms them. They go from being this monolithic concept into tangible animals sharing our world.
Yeah, they get an identity.
The atlas provides this context, noting that many of these animals are highly vulnerable. The oceanic white tip, for example, is listed as critically endangered in many parts of the world.
Is that mostly because of the longline fishing we discussed earlier?
Yes, exactly. They are pelagic wanderers, meaning they roam the open ocean, which makes them incredibly susceptible to commercial fleets.
Because they're just out there in the open water where the nets are.
Right. So when a dive master in Egypt takes the time to build an entire database, categorizing the unique schooling behaviors of the scalloped hammerhead, or mapping the shallow water hunting grounds of the black-tip reef shark, it localizes the global struggle.
It puts a face to the name.
It gives divers, and even just the ocean curious public, a direct line of sight into exactly what we stand to lose.
Okay, so if one person with a scuba tank and a spreadsheet can map out an entire vulnerable ecosystem in Egypt, it really begs the question of what the rest of us are supposed to be doing.
It's the ultimate question.
Right. If I'm sitting in a coffee shop in Ohio, completely landlocked, hundreds of miles from the nearest saltwater, do my choices actually reach the Red Sea? Like, how does someone in a landlocked state meaningfully participate in a July 14th Shark Awareness Day?
Well, this raises an important question about the nature of our global footprint. We often fall into the trap of thinking that because we cannot physically see the ocean from our window, our daily habits do not affect it.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. But the source material provides highly actionable steps that anyone can take, regardless of geography. First, It emphasizes education and visibility.
Okay, so like going to museums.
Yes. Participating in educational events at local aquariums or simply sharing accurate facts on social media using the hashtag, Shark Awareness Day.
That might seem like a passive step to some people, though.
It might. But remember the PR crisis we discussed at the very beginning. Shifting public perception away from that slasher movie villain narrative is the foundational building block of all conservation.
Oh, that makes sense. Because if people are terrified of an animal, they will not vote for policies that protect it.
Exactly. You are essentially helping to rebrand a 420-million-year-old animal just by sharing accurate information.
You become part of the PR team. You're correcting the record so that when conservation bills actually hit the ballot, the public isn't voting out of fear.
That is the social impact. Precisely. But the material also outlines direct physical actions. Advocating for sustainable fishing practices is massive.
Even if you don't live near the coast.
Even if you are landlocked. The seafood you consume in a restaurant or purchase at a grocery store has a specific origin. Choosing sustainably sourced seafood directly reduces the market demand for industrial fleets that cause all that massive bycatch.
Right, because if you reduce the demand for indiscriminately caught fish, you reduce the number of nets and long lines in the water.
Which directly saves the sharks that get caught in them by accident.
It's basically voting with your wallet to pull the hooks out of the water.
It really is.
And the Atlas also explicitly lists reducing plastic use as a meaningful way to make a difference, which makes total sense because plastic pollution doesn't respect state lines.
Not at all.
A plastic bag blown out of a trash can in Ohio lands in a river. And that river eventually empties into the ocean.
The water cycle connects every single landmass to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
The single-use plastics we rely on land inevitably degrade into microplastics, or they drift as larger debris into marine habitats.
And they just wreck the ecosystem.
They choke the coral reefs and contaminate the food web that these apex predators completely rely on.
So everything is connected.
Yes.
Yeah.
The everyday landlocked choices, bringing a reusable bag to the store, skipping single-use plastics, asking the restaurant where your seafood comes from, these decisions ripple outward.
They really do matter.
They directly impact the survival of the specific animals cataloged in that Red Sea Atlas. You do not have to be a dive master in Egypt to have a protective influence over an endangered oceanic whitetip.
It really distills this overwhelming global crisis right down to the tangible choices we make in our daily lives. I mean, it's so empowering.
It really is.
I think it's a good time to wrap up this discussion, and I want to remind you, the listener, that you are now officially armed with the ultimate dinner party knowledge.
Use it wisely.
Seriously, the next time someone brings up a sensationalized news story about a shark or makes a joke about the movie Jaws, you can confidently stop them in their tracks.
You have the facts now.
You can explain that sharks are actually ancient, tree-predating, ecosystem-balancing structural engineers. They act as the ocean's immune system, and they desperately need our protection, not our panic.
Well said.
We've seen how independent creators, like that single dive master in Alguna, are fighting to keep this knowledge accessible. And we've learned how a simple hashtag or a conscious choice at the grocery store fish counter can echo all the way to the Red Sea.
I think the contrast time is what truly sticks with me at the end of all this.
Oh, the 420 million years thing.
Yeah. If a species can survive for 420 million years, perfectly adapting to the oceans long before the first tree ever took root on land, yet it cannot survive a single century of human plastic and commercial overfishing. What does that tell us about the speed and scale of our own footprint on this planet?
Man, that is a heavy, necessary question to leave you with, and it is one we all need to be asking ourselves. Keep questioning the narratives you hear, keep looking deeper into the mechanics of the natural world, and remember that the shadow in the water isn't a monster, it's a marvel. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.